I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is January 28, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take the attendance by roll to establish a quorum. Adam?
Hanson, Rick.
Hanson, Rick, present.
Hanson, present. Wasilewick, Amy.
Wasilewick, present.
Wasilewick, present. Heintzman, Josh.
Heintzman, present.
Heintzman, present. Acom, Patty.
Acom, present.
Acom, present. Acklin, Susan.
Acklin, present.
Acklin, present. Backer, Jeff.
Backer, present.
Backer, present. Becker, Finn, Jamie.
Present.
Becker, Finn, present. Eklund, Rob.
Present.
Eklund, present. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, present.
Fisher, present. Green, Steve.
Green, present.
Green, present. Igo, Spencer.
Present.
Igo, present. Jordan, Sydney.
Present.
Jordan, present. Keeler, Heather.
Present.
Keeler, present. Lee, Fu.
Lee, present.
Lee, present. Lippert, Tan.
Lippert, present.
Lippert, present. Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, present.
Lewick, present. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, present.
Morrison, present. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, present.
Nelson, present. Tice, Tama.
Tice, present.
Tice is present. Cool to roll.
A quorum is present. The next item on the agenda is the minutes for Tuesday, January 26, 2021. Representative Jordan, have you reviewed the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes from January 26, 2021.
Representative Jordan moves the minutes for January 26, 2021. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Ayes have it. The minutes are approved. Next up, members, we have House File 228 by Representative Acom, a statewide invasive species management plan requirements modified. Representative Acom, will you move that House File 228 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I make that motion.
Representative Acom, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. One thing I think we can all agree on is that Minnesotans value our natural environment. We are the land of 10,000 lakes, ranging from small and quiet lakes to our large and grand Lake Superior. We're the home of the mighty Mississippi, and in fact, our state has more than 92,000 miles of rivers and streams. These water resources touch every corner of our state, from rural to urban and suburban. Something that all of these water resources have in common is that they are susceptible to aquatic invasive species. I'm offering House File 228, which requires the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to update the state management plan for invasive species by the end of 2021, and then every 5 years after that. The last time the plan was updated was in 2009. This bill also adds the impacts of climate change on invasive species as a criteria to address. Climate change impacts our environment and will determine how we manage invasive species. We have shorter duration of ice cover due to our warmer winters. We have altered stream flow patterns due to large rain events and flooding. These changes impact the pathways invasive species enter our systems and how they spread. This updated planning is critical to managing the spread and control of aquatic invasive species. I have two testifiers today who will help explain the real threat of invasive species on our natural resources and the importance of considering climate change as we develop and update our management plans. First up, I have Naomi Blinick from the University of Minnesota, a graduate student. Naomi?
Hi there. Thank you, Representative and Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak today in support of this modification. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, Ms. Blinick, if you could introduce yourself and state your name and for the record.
Yes, and who you're with. My name is Naomi Blinick, and I'm a graduate student in the Conservation Sciences Department at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and I'm a graduate fellow with the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I study aquatic invasive species, or AIS, which pose a system level threat to our water bodies here in Minnesota. But they don't exist in a vacuum. Their impacts are greatly affected by the conditions of the habitat they invade. And with climate change also causing system level changes to water bodies, it's common sense that managing for AIS means climate change has to be considered for effective strategies to be designed and implemented. Before I moved to Minnesota, I lived in several Western states where the impacts of climate change have been ever present in my generation in the forms of extreme droughts and wildfires. And moving to Minnesota, I saw that the effects of climate change are pervasive here too, but often in ways with different visibility than in the West and those red skies that we saw all over the news. Instead, it's shifts in seasons and species distributions, changes to precipitation patterns, warmer winters, and reduced lake ice. And these signs of large-scale ecological shifts that have been set in motion are no less serious or insidious than their Western counterparts. And for my and subsequent generations, they will be the norms, not the exceptions. Young people care deeply that this issue is taken seriously and integrated into broader management to conserve the natural resources held in public trust. So I work specifically in lakes, and we know that lakes are changing at a rapid pace due to multiple stressors, including AIS and climate change. And those stressors interact to influence lakes in complex and dynamic ways. Lakes may become more or less suitable for certain AIS as they get warmer, and new invaders that we haven't yet seen will likely be able to establish under approaching climate conditions, especially if historically cold winter temperatures are what we're limiting them. Conditions will improve for some currently established AIS, supporting range expansions and or dramatic increases in density and impacts. Warming AIS can act as stress multipliers. So some examples of this are combined warming and increased water clarity from zebra mussels increase the risk of UV damage and thermal stress to fish. Also, reduced snow covers on lake ice and shifting growing seasons will change the current competition dynamics among invasive and native aquatic plants. So our lab's work is focused on understanding lake responses to AIS and climate change, predicting potential future conditions, and identifying pathways for adapting to those changes. My research looks specifically at the mechanisms by which zebra mussels are changing food webs in Minnesota's walleye lakes. And this understanding will be even more important as the climate continues to warm and walleye's required cool water habitat shrinks, compounding the stress from zebra mussel-induced prey reduction and increased water clarity. So in short, they're getting squeezed out of their habitat and from multiple directions in lakes with zebra mussels due to the interactions between these two stressors. Other projects in our lab include quantifying fish responses to warming, predicting how other AIS like Eurasian water milfoil will respond to future climate conditions, and quantifying the increased rate of lake ice loss in recent decades. So there's a wealth of research on AIS and climate change from groups like mine, the Aquatic Invasive Research Species Research Center, and countless others that stands ready to support management. This is an opportunity to set the DNR up for success in proactively managing these intertwining threats and adapting to changing conditions. We all stand to benefit from management being as informed and evidence-driven as possible. So again, it's common sense to include this language to ensure that the management plan is updated regularly and that climate change impacts are recognized as a key consideration in how we in how the DNR manages AIS. We all want to work towards the conservation of our treasured lakes and rivers here in Minnesota, and to have the best shot at that, we need to give the DNR the full range of available tools to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions for Ms. Blinnick? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Blinnick, you know, you referenced some statistics as far as what you have found in the rivers and lakes. Do you have that data today, or is there a place I can access that?
Ms. Blinnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you have a specific question about what statistics, I don't think I actually mentioned any particular statistics or numbers, but the information on all of these projects can be found at the website for the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center, where links to reports, published publications, and data are available.
Representative Green, a follow-up?
Maybe you could put that up on there, because it's a little tough for me to write that down as far as the place and the link, but you did mention that that you have found a lot of changes in the rivers and the lakes, and that there's impact from, let's say, zebra mussels on the walleye. You know, so you did reference a lot of statistics and also on the climate change stuff, as far as the floods and whatever else. I'd just like to know where you got it. I mean, it's not really unusual to ask where the data comes from that you're referencing.
Certainly.
Ms. Blinnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly, the data about the zebra mussel impacts to walleye is my current master's research project, which I spent the last nearly 2 years working on. And the premise for that project comes from a prior project by my advisor who did find, I can share the link, I'll get the link in the chat, but there is a published paper, peer-reviewed, finding that in Minnesota's largest walleye lakes, lakes with zebra mussels had significantly lower success of walleye in their first year of life. And that's what inspired my current project, which is expanding that research into smaller and medium-sized lakes all across the state of Minnesota. So I'm happy to share the link to that specific project. It's just gonna take me a couple minutes to grab it here. And
we can get that up on the committee website as well, yeah, for the public to see.
Absolutely.
Representative Green, follow-up or?
Yeah, just one more. You know, you're talking about zebra mussels and that's great. I like to talk zebra mussels myself, but there's a lot of other invasive species. Now, on the studies that you're talking about, do you reference any of those or are you exclusively on the zebra mussels?
Well, my particular Thank you, Mr. Chair. My particular research focuses on zebra mussels. However, other studies in my lab that are currently underway, being undertaken at this very moment, are, for example, modeling how increased invasion risk and potential densities will change for Eurasian water milfoil with increases, with potential changing climate conditions. There is a research update talk that's publicly hosted from the MACIRC Research Management Showcase this past year that I'm happy to share on that project. And we have several other publications in press. They're not available quite at this moment, but my lab website does have links to several publications that address these issues, and I'm happy to share that as well. So I'm going to make a list of all the things I'm going to share with you and get those available for you.
Thank you, Ms. Blinnick. Representative Green, we have a few other questions, so I'm going to move to Representative Heintzman.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Blinnick, in your testimony, you mentioned a number of different concerns that you have as it relates to how we're working on the AIS issue and some of the connections that you made to changing climate and other changes in water, I thought were really interesting, but I'm still not quite hearing how you are building an argument for the bill. In other words, the bill, in my mind, saying that the DNR has fallen short in their planning and needs to somehow accelerate that. And maybe Representative Akam wants to speak to this, but it was your testimony that I was trying to follow and try to figure out what that argument is and where do you think the DNR has fallen short?
Ms. Blinnick or Representative Akam?
Can I just maybe comment on that? Thank you for the question, Representative Heintzman. And I think that when you look at the management plan that the DNR currently was last updated in 2009, and the things that they looked at, climate change was not amongst them. And we are seeing today in our state impacts of climate change, and they're certainly impacting our aquatic resources. And both in what I stated earlier, as well as what Ms. Blinnick referred to, that presents itself in larger rainfall events, in less times of ice in the winter. And so I think these things, these changes are important to take into account as we're looking at aquatic invasive species and their spread or control.
Representative Heintzman is...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do a follow-up. I appreciate that answer, Representative Akam, but I still haven't heard any evidence that the DNR has somehow not taken into account climate change in their overall approach to this issue. Now, if you're saying that they ignored it in 2009 and there's not been any adjustment, maybe at the county level on up to DNR, I'd be really interested to hear in a presentation how that hasn't happened. And I just didn't hear that in the presentation. So that's why I was giving Ms. Blinnick an opportunity to respond.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Acom.
I'm not trying to say that the DNR isn't addressing climate change in their management. I think it's not been included in the management plan that was last released in 2009. And so this plan is a collaborative, coordinated effort that is done with many other agencies and jurisdictions. And so in order for it, and it takes time to do it and input. And so they haven't done it since 2009. I think that we all can agree that law management plans need to be updated on a regular basis. And so I think the two modifications that are made to the bill are addressing two different things. One is that it needs to be updated regularly, and the other is that when it is updated, it needs to include climate change.
Representative Heintzman. We'll move on to Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Blinnick, thank you for the work that you do on this. Mine's a pretty basic question. I don't know if you guys are tracking these numbers, but a lot of our counties have used their existing AIS funding and they've turned it over to lake associations and other things to purchase boats and cleaning stations and that sort of thing. Is there any data being collected that shows whether these things are effective? I think they're working well in some areas, but I especially wonder on our big lakes that have a lot of multiple accesses.
Ms. Blinnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative, for that question. That is a very complex question, and I'm not sure I'm entirely qualified to answer the broad scale, is it working or not, but I can tell you that state investment in preventing AIS spread, educating the public about the risks of AIS, from my personal perspective of what I've seen, is effective, but it varies widely across the state and with different types of implementation. And so to address the previous question just a bit, I think that including the language that climate change impacts must be considered in future AIS management is really provides clear direction to the DNR and state agencies and eliminates any ambiguity about whether or not it's something that needs to be considered. There is a good study. I don't want to download it right now because I don't want to mess with my internet connection, but there's a great recent study about how state and federal managers, while they agree that climate change is a big risk, they very rarely address it. And part of that issue is that there's ambiguity on whether or not they should and how they should. And so I think providing this clear direction would be a great benefit both to the on-the-ground managers and the stakeholders. But yeah, I think that the AIS prevention measures that are currently happening are certainly making a big impact, and there's always room for improvement.
Representative Eklund, Chair. No, that's good, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your testimony today, Ms. Blinnick. This is really pretty fascinating. One of the questions I have is, can you describe a little bit about your lab and how you integrate field work into your lab? We have a lot of lakes, and we have, I'm sure you, so I will also just say, you know, I have a number of ichthyologists in my family, and I think they all got into it for the field work aspect. So can you talk a little bit about how you conduct field work and what those scientific processes look like when they meet your lab?
Thank you. Yes, certainly.
Go ahead.
So sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. I'm happy to answer that. I have a field background before coming to graduate school, and I came to this project specifically because there was a heavy fieldwork component. But my lab actually has both fieldwork components and very heavy statistical predictive modeling components. And so we're made up of people with all sorts of skills and backgrounds to accomplish both of those goals. So for my project specifically, the fieldwork requires, we've visited 14 lakes in the last two summers to get a broad sample for this zebra mussel walleye food web impact study. And it involves sampling from the top to bottom of food webs in lakes. So plankton samples, searching along the shoreline for insects, aquatic insects. We sampled juvenile and shoreline fish. And then we work with the DNR to capitalize on their gill net surveys throughout the summer. So we're really getting every section of that food web. There are other studies in the pipeline that will be looking at environmental DNA techniques. And so that will involve collecting water, filtered water samples from lakes. And there's other things coming in the pipeline, but my lab is actually fairly new. It's Dr. Gretchen Hansen's lab, and we are new at the University of Minnesota as of just about 2 years ago. So we are establishing how we do different kinds of work, but yes, there is definitely a field components. And then once we have all that field work accomplished, there's a lot of lab work to analyze all of our samples and then some pretty heavy statistical modeling as well.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Blinnick, could you tell me why the University of Minnesota maybe saw fit to incorporate more need for AIS research as part, I mean, they're obviously a land grant institution, but can you talk, do you know at all about the decision to devote so much study to AIS in Minnesota?
Ms. Blinnick.
Thank you. Well, the University of Minnesota is basically the hosting body of the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center, which I know has spent a lot of time, I believe, working with this committee in the past. So the MASERC, as it's called, is a pretty unique entity and leverages the power of research at the university to this body that can work with multiple stakeholder groups to reach shared goals. And so I think Minnesota being the land of 10,000 lakes, which is actually an undercount, we're in a unique position both as a living lab, as a state. We have more potential study sites than just about anywhere else. We have this world-renowned set of researchers based out of the university and strong partnerships with state agencies. And so I think the university is just in a very unique position. I can't claim to be an expert in the rationale behind founding of MASERC, but that has been my understanding.
Mr. Chair,
One more, yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then Ms. Blinnick, just to kind of wrap up, can you talk a little bit about what you have observed in your study as it relates to climate change? Just to really put a finer point on it for the committee.
Certainly, thank you. Well, I will tell you that one of the challenges in my study is looking at how food webs are shifting in walleye lakes, and we have had a very hard time even finding walleye, juvenile walleye specifically. And so they are facing so many threats that to just say, well, we're having a hard time finding walleye, it must be XYZ, is of course not appropriate. But it's clear that we see trends in increasing temperature, and we know the temperature has increased temperatures have negative effects on walleye success. We see less walleye. That's why we're investigating what is the driver. So we're looking at these food web changes. We're also tracking researcher working on this project is looking at, you know, different drivers to recruitment across lakes with zebra mussels and lakes without zebra mussels to try and tease out other trends. But even just this summer doing field work, I mean, I would go to a lake, or last summer, I remember going to a lake to meet with the DNR to do some sampling. And I got stuck in the parking lot while this deluge dropped, I don't know, 4 inches of rain probably in an hour. I mean, it was phenomenal. I've never seen anything like it. And the DNR guys had the same. They're just like, this is insane. Like the amount of intense precipitation, and that had driven up. We'd had events like that all summer in this area, and we'd had just such a hard time catching these juvenile walleye. And one thought was like, well, the water level is so high. Like our traditional methods for catching walleye where we're looking for them are not even going to work because we can't seine in these habitats that are now too deep. So the increased precipitation, warm water stress, I mean, we're not going to find young walleye in near shore zones when the temperature is so high. They just won't be there. So it makes it harder to even just get the samples when these effects of temperature are, at least we know, driving them away from these habitats. And how that is playing out in the bigger picture is something we're really interested in finding out.
Great. Representative Lee, and then we'll go back to Representative Akam for her next testifier. So Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Akam and Ms. Blinnick, for coming in to present on this. And I just want to reiterate the point that Representative Akam made, that, you know, 2009 is 11 years ago, and so we do need an updated plan. And Ms. Blinnick, kind of to your last point about the trend of increased temperature, can you just shed some light to the members of the committee? You know, what have you seen change from 2009 until today?
Ms. Blinnick.
Thank you. Well, we have seen generalized increases in temperature. I can say specifically in Minnesota, we're seeing the very large increases in winter temperatures, which are leading to reduced lake ice, which has some pretty wide ranging impacts on winter ecology in lakes. We know that this also leads to increased like UV radiation to fish, like I mentioned, and that decreases fitness of young fish. I can't say specifically from a place of authority what has changed specifically between 2009 and now, but I think from a general stance, I think what we see is a more serious attitude towards making sure that we're considering all the changes in our systems. The trend is shifting towards taking a more holistic view of how ecosystems are changing. We can't just look at one single piece of the puzzle. We need to be looking at everything from a more comprehensive stance to make sure that we're not missing important things. I mean, if we're just looking at one little corner of the picture over here and trying to figure out what's going on while there's huge system-wide changes happening over on the other side of the picture, we won't be well equipped to manage what we're seeing now, anticipate what's going to happen in the future, and adapt to those future changes.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman, I'd like to at least get the next testifier in, and then maybe we'll take questions for both. So if that's okay.
I had a question for you, Mr. Chair, if you had just a chance to quickly take it, that'd be great.
Yep.
I'll wait till after you're finished here.
Okay. Representative Akam, if you'd like to introduce your next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, I have Jeff Forrester with the Lake and River Advocates.
Mr. Forrester, welcome.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forrester. I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates. And I'd like to thank Representative Akam for bringing this bill forward. We support the bill for two primary reasons. Since 2009, a lot has changed. There's been significant changes in the research due to the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center and the tools that they have available to both track and manage aquatic invasive species. Data collection has changed both within the DNR and at large. The number of infestations has changed dramatically. In 2009, we were looking at dozens of lakes with zebra mussels. Now we're looking at hundreds of lakes. The funding mechanisms have changed with the advent of the county AIS prevention aid in 2014. And we have new species. We have starry stonewort, which didn't exist in the state in 2009. And one of the things that I see kind of over time is, I think early on there was a emphasis on preservation, on preserving what we have. That I think is over. What we're doing now is we're managing change. And we're managing change at an accelerating rate. And so the goal, I think, ceases to be preservation and more a goal of resiliency. And, you know, that's a different conversation. that isn't represented in the 2009 plan at all. It's not really about the idea of change. It's about shielding or containment. And those might still be great strategies, but it's changed some. And one of the big changes is climate, as we've heard. And that changes which species might be viable in different waters. It changes how those species react within a lake. For instance, we're seeing lakes, particularly shallow lakes with curly leaf pondweed or starry stonewort, where because there's less ice and less snow, more light gets through, and the species continue to grow over the summer. So one management technique that they're starting to talk about is literally putting blankets down on top of the ice to shield the plants below from sunlight to mimic snow cover that we no longer have. And that's not really part of the 2009 thinking at all. Climate's a huge variable, and I agree that we've looked at, there's rules and there's regulations and there's guidelines and things. But the rules tend to be static and the guidelines tend to be static, and that can prevent problems in a system that's changing kind of at an increasing rate. So I think that having this, every 5 years with a focus on climate change, because that is one of the larger drivers of this change, is wise and appropriate, and we support it.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that Bob Meyer is here today, and we're hearing quite a lot of testimony suggesting that DNR doesn't take into account climate change in any of their work around this issue and around AIS. So I'm hoping that he would have an opportunity to testify. I'd like to hear specifically from him if I could, but if there's somebody else from DNR that would like to chime in, that would be fine.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Forrester? Is Commissioner Meyer there, or Heidi Wolf from the DNR?
Mr. Chairman, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. We did have the opportunity yesterday to meet with Representative Acom and talk with her about her bill, about what this plan is used for and how it's tied to hundreds of thousands of dollars of federal funding, and it needs federal approval. And it's really a living plan. I would like to have Heidi Wolf talk about those issues and some of the other ideas we might have to address this. We deal with climate change on a daily basis. We talked with you, and you'll see a piece in the governor's budget dealing with many different pieces of climate change. For the DNR, it's reforestation, planting trees, and carbon sequestration. But climate change is real. We understand that, and we deal with it every day. And Heidi can also explain how the current plan actually contains climate change information with that. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Heidi if I could.
Representative Heintzman, is that what you were looking for? Or?
I will have some follow-up questions. I'm just making sure that I'm on the list, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Heidi?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I just want to give you a little bit of background information about the plan and how it interacts. And first, I want to reassure you, we are looking at climate change on a daily basis. As you've heard from some of the other folks who testified, range expansion and risk assessments really do focus a lot on climate change, and our changing current temperatures here in Minnesota will be changing the species who can survive here over winter, things like that. And so it's a constant daily part of our work. I also want to let you know, I'm very happy to say the plan is already in process of being updated. Minnesota DNR recognized the need for that in 2020 and actually hired a temporary position to update the plan. I do want to explain that the plan is owned by MESAC, which is the Minnesota Invasive Species Advisory Council. That is a group made up of many different groups, including other state agencies such as PCA and MDA, and it's also lake associations, soil and watershed districts, and like St. Croix River Association. So a whole lot of folks came together to create that plan in 2009. Like I mentioned, we recognize that it needs to be updated and are concerned about getting that done, and that is in process. It's kind of a heavy lift. So we had to hire staff to take care of it and guide that process, since DNR is not the owner, but just one of the members of that group. I do want to explain that the plan for Minnesota DNR is also tied to funding. It's not for any of the other folks who are part of writing that plan, but DNR actually gets funding through that because it's a requirement to have a state plan with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for two funding sources that we get. One is the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding, which is about $800,000 annually. The other is a state interstate AIS funding. DNR typically gets $98,000 for the state and another $98,000 for a St. Croix interjurisdictional grant that we do. And so that having the plan and the plan being approved by the ANS task force is a requirement. The challenge a little bit for that plan is that it takes up to 2 years to get it reviewed and approved by the ANS task force after we make any changes other than typos, and we can update that species list without going through federal review. Other than that, it has to go through federal review. And yeah, I'm just really glad to say, another thought with, we're happy to add climate change to the management plan. I'm also happy to say that the current draft that's being worked on does include climate change, and that we'd also like to potentially add that to our requirement for our annual report and plan moving forward so that it is included there. That is an annual requirement that we do, and so it's a little bit more adaptive to current and changing things. And if you look back at those reports over the last 10 years, you'll see that we're mentioning things like eDNA, climate change, range expansion, and some of the other issues that climate impacts, and things like new species, starry stonewort, what we're doing about that, how can that be impacted. So that might be another way to look at this issue and making sure it's wrapped into DNR's work and plans and being represented in a way that people in the public can see that we're working on that.
Ms. Wolf, if you could just state your name and your position for the record.
Yes. My name is Heidi Wolf. I supervise the Minnesota DNR's Invasive Species Unit.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question, but that's turned more into a comment. And I don't mean to sound a grouchy, Mr. Chair, but you know, we're looking at deadlines just came out coming up in the coming month. Well, March specifically, we're getting close to February, sorry. And I'm just hopeful that we're gonna be looking at some, and this is where it's gonna sound grouchy, but more substantive legislation. DNR is obviously taking in a lot of information over time when legislature maybe isn't working on this particular issue. And it sounds like from Ms. Wolf's presentation or explanation, that there's no question that climate change is a part of that process, and it's even a higher level than here in Minnesota, but a level at the federal component there as well being used. So, you know, I'm just glad to hear that DNR is on top of this. I don't necessarily see this as absolutely critical legislation, but I'm not saying that it's wrong to have an opportunity to bring it up, but you know, at the same time, I hope that we're working closely with DNR and working on issues that are really going to affect Minnesotans, because we have our work cut out for us this session, Mr. Chair. So looking forward to the coming legislation over the next few weeks.
Thank you, Representative Heinzman. I think if you compared to any of the other committees, we've probably passed more or bills through our committee than I think any others at this point in time. But the point here is that, climate change is an existential threat to our world. And that if we think about going back to 2009, how dramatically the world has changed and how much, and we've just had testimony with evidence of how just one component of our not only environment economy, but our economy with walleye fishing could be impacted, but how the web of life, which we are part of, I think I can think of nothing more important than the threat to how things are working on our planet. So it's not too much to put into legislation, updating a plan, including climate change, and doing that by statute. Appreciate the work that's being done. I think it's important that as the representatives of the people that we try to make sure that the work is being done and make sure that it's being updated and to make sure that we have the best available science that's there. And we can do that through law. Mm-hmm. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And I just wanted to offer a comment that really builds on your comment as well. I want to thank Representative Akam for bringing this bill forward. I think it's especially timely. We just had an article in the Star Tribune today that talked about Lake Superior not icing over in the way that it has in the past and the way that could affect invasive species or algae blooms in Lake Superior. And this is incredibly substantive. Climate change is an existential threat. It's clear that our statute needs to catch up with the reality of climate change. And it's great that our agencies are tackling climate change, but making sure that our statute is directing them to will allow them to deepen that work. It will reinforce that work and allow us to accelerate our response, which is what we need to do to be able to offer a livable planet to our children and grandchildren. So I just want to thank Representative Akam for this work. I think it's central to the work of this committee, and I think this will be a good step forward for us.
Representative Green, then Representative Backer, and then Representative Morrison, and then we'll have to wrap it up because we have some agencies that want to give us some information. So,
okay, Representative Green. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the DNR, and whether Mr. Myers or Ms. Wolf wants to answer this is up to them. But given the fact that it sounds like if this bill passes to update this plan will take at least 2 years just to update it. Every time you want to update it, by the time you get through the process with the federal agencies and whatever they are that you have to go through, that you're already seem to be doing these things, aside, and we're in the middle of a hiring freeze, aside from adding some more people to do this, how will this change what you're doing already today?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. We had a great discussion with the author yesterday just about that exactly and the five-year time frame and how it fits in with the federal issues. This is something that we're doing right now. We want to continue doing, and we're confident that we can continue working on the language so it meets the goals that are there, also puts things in statute as Representative Akam and Representative Lippert just stated the intentions of that as well. So we're looking to come up with something that will minimize the fiscal impact of this, but also protect us and our children from making sure that we incorporate this language into future plans. So I understand your concern. It's a concern we share on a daily basis at the DNR and the entire executive branch, right? So we're looking at how do we do things? How do we accomplish goals? And climate change is really important, so we're trying to figure out a path forward on this.
Representative Green, is that?
That'll do it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Backer.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. You know, I know Assistant Commissioner Meyer knows that we don't always agree on the same page, and we have some lively discussions. In this thing, I do believe the DNR is on top of it. I just like to remind people professionally, it's back in the 1960s, some scientists believed that by 1975, the human race would perish by famine caused by climate change. Funny, today, you know, we're 7 billion strong. Now, if we fast forward to the mid 70s, we had scientists claiming that the world's going in a new ice age. In other words, we were going to have global freezing. The good news is we in Minnesota has done a good job, take care of our environment. our air quality has improved, the water quality has improved, and our economy, we also have to keep an eye on too, as our population expands. So I'm a believer that DNR is already doing a good job. I do agree with Representative Heisman. We need to be focusing on other issues. I know the chair will disagree with me, and I respect his opinion. At the same time, we also have to look, as a chemist, we as scientists don't get things right all the time. I'm not saying that there's not a concern. What I'm saying is, if we look at past history, the doom and gloom scenarios have not always happened. And I really want to give hats on for what the DNR has been doing with this arena, the executive branch, and so forth. So I think they're on top notch. I would like us to be focusing on other issues in the committee. And that's my two cents. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Acum, for bringing this bill forward, and thank you, Ms. Blinnick, for sharing your important research. I was wondering if Mr. Forrester would mind sharing again some of the statistics about aquatic invasive species in our more than 11,000 lakes here in Minnesota, just to kind of remind us all of what an urgent and important issue this is.
Mr. Forrester.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips. I can get, the sort of rate of expansion to you. But suffice it to say, what was, I think it was, I'm totally going from memory here, but I think in 2009, we were looking at like 30 lakes that had zebra mussels, maybe 50. And I believe the last number we saw, Heidi would probably know this, would be closer to 400. And, those also create changes. So the water gets clearer with zebra mussels and allows more sunlight down, and plant communities start to move around within a lake. So it's sort of a snowball effect. And then you add the climate change piece to it. And one of the things with the increased runoff is the charging of phosphorus and nutrients into the lakes from these pulses of, rain, these massive rain events, mega rain events. And then in areas where there's an urban area, we noticed this last summer, my wife and I were out walking. It was one of these big thunderstorms after, kind of a period of a few days of heat. And so we went for a rain walk, and, the water in the street that was rushing down into the storm sewers and then into the city lakes here was like bath water. So what's the impacts of that on, the milfoil and potential zebra mussels and things like this, of this, hundreds, maybe millions of gallons of 90 degree water rushing into the lakes all at once? There's just a great deal of change happening on the lakes right now. And people are seeing it off the end of their docks. I'm getting calls from across the state saying we have plants where we never had plants. We're losing plants where we used to have them. On Lake Vermilion, we've lost a lot of our wild rice beds. So it's impacting where waterfowl are going. So it's just sort of this cascade. Vastly different picture than 2009.
Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Forrester. And sorry for putting you on the spot. Also want to thank DNR for acknowledging and working to mitigate the effects of climate change.
Representative Lewick, is it quick or?
Yes, relatively quick. I guess just a general comment. I found there's a wealth of pretty up-to-date information available on the DNR website on literally every substantive water body in the state of Minnesota. So sometimes it just takes a lot of looking and research, but pretty much that information is there. But I would like to ask Assistant Commissioner Meyer, do you have any perspective on the cost that might be associated with dropping what you're doing and doing something unique here? Because it sounds like this would force you to change what you're doing, which that's not always bad, but it would seem that any idea here, I see there's no fiscal note. And apparently we do this stuff for free, but I know better as a creature of both state and federal government.
Representative Lewick, there will be, you know, we're holding this over. It's not moving out. There will be time for a fiscal note, you know, and we're going to hear more from the DNR on when that is done. So I do want to recognize Mr. Forrester. I think last time when you testified, you were suffering from COVID, I think was indicated during that testimony. And so just want to recognize your recovery and good to see you back.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we have three agencies that we need to get through their presentations. We'll try to come back maybe to DNR at the end on that question, but I do want to get through this bill. Any further discussion? Representative Akam renews her motion that House, Representative Akam, do you have a closing comment?
No, other than I appreciate the discussion and happy to continue to talk with DNR about it, and I renew my motion.
Representative Akam renews her motion that House File 228 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. You know, the wonderful thing about being the representatives of the people is, you know, we are a separate and equal branch of government with the executive branch. So we can talk with them and work with them and see where there's opportunity for agreement, but also representing the people, we can pass legislation that provides direction as well. So with that, we will hear from the Environmental Quality Board. Ms. Pratt.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm gonna go ahead and share my screen here. Mr. Chair, please let me know if you're able to see that.
I can see it. Other members? Proceed.
Great. Thank you.
State your name and position for the record, Ms. Pratt.
Thank you. My name is Katie Pratt, Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board, and thank you very much for the opportunity to present today on behalf of the board. Here we go, just getting my slide settled. The Environmental Quality Board dates back nearly 50 years and is a unique organization in the state of Minnesota and nationally. EQB is charged with governing and implementing one of the state's foundational environmental laws, the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, or MEPA. The board consists of 9 state agency leaders, 8 public members, and is currently chaired by Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Commissioner Laura Bishop. We have a staff team of 9, and the recommended budget for the next biennium is $2.6 million. Of that, about 85% is general fund and 15% is environmental fund. This is a continuation of our current funding level. And you can see there from the pie chart that the expenses break down about 70% goes towards salaries and benefits. About a quarter is shared expenses with the MPCA for things like IT, human resources, and office space. And the remainder of the budget is for attorney general expenses and other expenses. EQB's work falls into 3 buckets. First, we have oversight over Minnesota's environmental review program. Second, we work across agencies to address critical and emerging environmental issues as well as policy development. And then finally, we serve as a forum for public engagement. In the following slides, I'll give just a few highlights from our work in each of these areas. As I just mentioned, EQB has oversight over the state's environmental review program and is charged with making program improvements. Environmental review is a planning tool designed to engage communities on large development projects prior to issuing approvals. EQB works with state and local governments, businesses, and the public to foster a process that is transparent, accountable, efficient, and sustains a healthy environment and a strong economy for Minnesota. One of the principal ways we do this is by providing technical assistance to project proposers, governmental units, and the public. We have a phone and email hotline where anyone can ask questions of our staff. We also frequently give presentations to groups wanting to better understand how environmental review processes work. Another way that we carry out our charge is through program improvement projects, and I want to highlight two of these that are currently underway. The first is that this fall, EQB launched an interactive map that shows environmental review projects, active environmental review projects across the state. So you can see a screenshot of that map there on the slide. Users can click on the map and find information about public comment periods, notices of decision, and links to relevant documents. So prior to this map, there was no easy, quick way for Minnesotans to go in and see what was happening around the state. So we're excited about this improvement. Coming forward in 2021, we'll also be launching a searchable database of environmental review projects to give Minnesotans another way to access information and for EQB to also generate improved data about our program. A second project is that the board is considering changes to integrate climate information into the environmental review program. The goal of this project is to develop a consistent process for disclosure of new greenhouse gas emissions from projects that may have the potential for significant environmental impact. The board has identified climate change as an important issue facing our state, and currently climate effects are not consistently evaluated in the program. The changes under consideration would provide important information to Minnesotans while minimizing uncertainty for project proposers and RGUs, as well as providing tools and guidance. So in December, the board reviewed draft recommendations, and we are spending the first half of 2021 getting input from Minnesotans on these recommendations before the board makes any decisions. We'll be hosting a comment period, listening sessions, a survey, and one-on-one interviews to get as much feedback as we can about the process. And there's information on our web.
Ms. Pratt, we're getting a bit of feedback, or at least I am. I don't know if other members are. Proceed, but I'm not sure what was happening there.
I'll pause for a minute. Are other folks hearing me okay?
No, it's a bit difficult, well, unfortunately.
Mr. Chair, have I been breaking up consistently and am I continuing to break up?
It's been accelerating. The beginning of the presentation was clear, but now it's getting to be more, and it is continuing.
Okay, Mr. Chair, let me just, I don't want to take too much time here, but let me see. I think the best way to resolve this might be to just not share my screen. Here, I'll stop my video also.
Okay.
Okay, let me try stopping my video and continuing on. And Mr. Chair, please just jump in.
That is clear. You're clear now. That seems to have been it. So proceed.
Okay. Thank you. I always shut down as many things as I can while doing this. Okay. Moving on then to the next slide. Another important work area for EQB is our interagency collaboration. So EQB manages a wide variety of projects that need a coordinated multi-agency response. And these projects are signed either in statute, through executive order, by the legislature, public requests, or board priorities. And each of these projects brings together some of the brightest minds in state government to collaborate on solutions that are bigger than their individual agencies' jurisdictions. We had a very busy year in 2020. We worked across agencies on issues as diverse as emerald ash borer, solar development on Clough's landfills, to pollinator protection. At one point, we were managing six different interagency teams involving over 70 staff from across the agencies. We truly are a hub of collaboration. And you can see some of our 2021 project areas listed on the slide there, continuing our pollinator protection work, implementation of a state water plan, which is focused on the impact of climate change on our water resources, as well as emerald ash borer, solar enclosed landfills, and supporting the work of the climate change subcabinet. And finally, public engagement is fundamental to EQB. We make our best decisions on the environment when we have opportunities for the public to weigh in and when we represent broad interests across the state. Our public board members are a unique asset in this regard. They bring perspectives from their communities and their areas of expertise to board discussions and decisions. In 2020, we reached over 3,800 Minnesotans through in-person and virtual meetings and events, webinars, surveys, and one-on-one conversations. In 2021, our board has a particular interest in expanding conversations about environmental policies and programs in Minnesota, programs to more Minnesotans from around the state and across sectors and of diverse backgrounds and experiences. And with that, thank you for your time today, and I will stand by for questions.
Great. We have a couple questions. Representative Lippert and then Representative Heintzman. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Pratt, for the presentation. I want to ask about solar on closed landfills. I had a chance to just look at the report briefly. It seems like an absolute no-brainer that we would be using that land and putting solar there and making sure that land's put to good use and helping us meet our climate goals. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about some of the most promising ways forward. I know there are a few options that were listed, but what do you think makes the most sense for us to move forward and to make that happen in Minnesota?
Ms. Pratt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lippert. I absolutely agree. It is a no-brainer. It's a win-win for Minnesotans to move down this pathway. What was identified in that report is that there are some sites that don't have bond restrictions currently that might be the most promising to move forward on right away. However, we do need to look, and this would be something to talk in more depth about to MPCA about, is about their statutory obligations under the closed landfill program and whether we need to make any adjustments to make sure that they have the authorities needed to be able to kind of carry out and facilitate land use in that way. So that would be a first step, is to look at sites that don't have those bond restrictions. And then from there, to think about options for sites that have bond restrictions, and the report outlines some ways we might, begin to move through that process.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Pratt. I think it's helpful just to hear you talk through some of our options. I would just encourage those conversations to move forward. I think, we just need to be making use of the capacity that we have and to move forward with solar as quickly as we can.
And Ms. Pratt, that was a statutorily required report, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that was correct, statutorily required. There was a one-time appropriation to EQB, but we partnered with MPCA, MMB, and Commerce, and I'm forgetting someone, but we did partner with some other agencies on working on that.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Pratt, I just had a couple of questions. This is a relatively new agency, and I'm curious kind of where staffing is at. Has it increased, decreased in the last 6 years? And then also, as we're talking about your budget request, is it the same or has it changed over the years? Where are we at today on those two items?
Ms. Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman. Just to clarify your question a little bit, when you say EQB is new, we actually date back, EQB by statute dates back to 1973 and is nearly 50 years in existence. So we've been around a while. EQB has changed. We currently have an administrative relationship with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So our funding there, they are our fiscal agent. Our funding runs through them. And the funding that is recommended in the governor's budget is not an increase or a decrease from our current biennium. It is the same funding. And that allows us to maintain our current staffing levels and a stable staffing level, which is absolutely critical to doing the work at EQB. We have, one of the most important resources we have is an extraordinarily talented staff team, and maintaining that is critical to doing this good work that, we do quite a lot of with a small, I like to say a small but mighty team.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My follow-up question would be, exactly where is staffing at? I think a number of years ago, it was like five or six people. And I apologize for suggesting that there was no EQB up until recently. I guess it really wasn't on a lot of people's radar, and some of your activity probably wasn't really as visible as maybe it is now. So we're wondering about those changes, and that's why I was asking, and where is staffing at today?
Ms. Pratt, FTEs.
Yes, thank you. We have 9 FTEs. We actually have some vacancies we're working to fill right now, but we're at 9 FTEs, which has been a stable number now for the last couple of years. If you look back over the last decade, EQB has, you know, at one point when EQB moved over from the planning department over to MPCA, we had very small staff, and it has EQB has over the last decade been in a process of stabilizing at a staff level that has allowed us to, you know, to do the type of work that we're really mandated to do.
Thank you. Members, any other questions for Ms. Pratt? Thank you. And all of those reports are available on your website, correct?
That is correct, and we're happy to give you any information or any briefings on any of those reports. And thank you so much for your time today.
Please pass on to your staff our thanks for their work for the people of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Explore Minnesota Tourism. Mr. Edmond.
Yeah, so hello, Mr. Chair. My name is John Edmond. I'm the director of Explore Minnesota. I'm also here with Leanne Kispert, my assistant director, who will help me with part of this presentation or any of the questions that you may have. Leanne is uploading my presentation. I'll go through this relatively quickly. We actually submitted to you a longer version of the deck with videos, but in the interest of time, we just wanted to go through some of the top line information that we're gonna present to you right now. Next slide, please. So Explore Minnesota, as most of you are likely aware, we're a separate state agency whose job is very simply to market the state of Minnesota to consumers, to facilitate travel to and within the state of Minnesota. We are a separate agency. We're guided by an Explore Minnesota Tourism Council, which is made up of 28 individuals all throughout the state. In terms of size of our organizations, we're currently at 38 FTEs or 38 individuals. About a year ago, at the beginning of this pandemic, we were at 52 FTEs. So we've really had a number of positions that have come open because of retirement, and we've not been able to fill them due to hiring freezes and other restructuring. But we are substantially smaller than we were before. Next slide, please. This shows basically it's sort of the history of our budget. Right now, we're at a budget of about $14.2 million. The vast majority, over 65% of our budget, goes into marketing and promotion. We rank in the country, if you look at other state tourism budgets, this was actually prior to the pandemic, roughly in the middle, about 22nd in the country. There are some bigger, some smaller since the pandemic and all the budget issues that various states have been having. We don't have an updated number on that. But prior to the pandemic, we were ranked about in the middle of the pack. And we've been pretty much the same budget for the last four bienniums. Next slide, please. This is actually from our strategic plan. And this was, again, prior to the pandemic. First of all, tourism in Minnesota is a $16 billion industry across the state of Minnesota. That's in terms of sales in the leisure and hospitality industry. We generate about $1 billion in state taxes and $275,000 jobs. These basic pillars here, brand awareness, consumer engagement, partner collaboration, is sort of the core of what we do. And this is where we are going to try to aspire to prior to the pandemic, to grow the number of visitors, sales, taxes, and jobs in the state of Minnesota. Next slide, please. And then, of course, COVID-19 hit, and that significantly impacted the leisure and hospitality industry. To put in perspective, the tourism industry in Minnesota, leisure and hospitality sales decreased by $7.1 billion in 2020. This is from figures from Oxford Economics. Our employment in the leisure and hospitality industry has been down 27% to an estimated about 200,000 jobs. And by sector, food and drink down 23%. Accommodations down 37%, arts, entertainment, and recreation down 36%. Statewide occupancy rate this last year was down about 42%. with Minneapolis-St. Paul being the hardest area hit with a decreased occupancy of 52%. International travel has pretty much fallen off the charts to almost non-existent. But when we're looking at international travel returning to Minnesota and throughout the country, we're looking at several years out to 2024 or beyond. Next slide, please. We just recently did a survey with the Federal Reserve, Hospitality Minnesota, as well as using our database. And we asked a number of different questions. A lot more of the survey results is in the longer packet that I submitted to you. But this is one that I wanted to share. We basically asked the question of, well, what is the current financial health of businesses? And it does vary a little bit by business sector within the hospitality industry. Attractions and entertainment, basically 35% of those businesses are declining. Accommodations declining about 43%. 43% of those respondents said that they're declining. And I do have to point out that it's a little different depending on what segment of the accommodation sector you're talking about. Resorts and campgrounds did a little better as people were trying to social distance this last summer, but hotels have been significantly impacted. But the sector that—
Mr. Edmund, we've got a question, so I'm going to take Representative Igo.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is for Mr. Edmund here. I'm just curious, you know, what has Explore Minnesota been doing to partner with all of our, you know, bars and restaurants across the state that were obviously very impacted during this time to partner with them to help them come back stronger than ever?
Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Igo, we've been working quite a bit with Hospitality Minnesota and the restaurant industry in terms of trying to encourage support of the restaurants and encouraging takeout, encouraging what people are able to do. I'm actually in a couple of other slides here going to show some of the promotions we've done specifically to address the food and drink establishments throughout the state of Minnesota, because we do recognize that's such a key part of travel and tourism, and it's a heart of our hospitality industry. And without even just local people supporting those restaurants and bars, that they wouldn't be able to survive. A lot of them haven't, but I'll represent, I'll be able to explain some of the things we've been doing in that area as I go along.
Okay, Representative Igo.
Yeah, thank you. Like I said, that's very important as representing rural Minnesota, especially the Lakes Country. You know, our bars and restaurants were incredibly impacted with, you know, people not being there and being able to attend those restaurants. So I look forward to hearing about that. Thank you.
Mr. Edmund.
Next slide, please. Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we were able to do, we were a little bit later and able to getting out into some of our messaging to potential consumers in Minnesota and surrounding states earlier this year. We did this campaign a little bit later into the spring summer season, which was really an aspirational message. It was a message of hope, and basically it was telling folks, and it's focused primarily on Minnesotans, we'll see you soon. Maybe you're not going to be able to travel the way that you'd like to, but we have a great product in the state of Minnesota, and we want them to consider traveling at the point that they are able when protocols open up and things change. So you'll be able to see that spot later on as you look through the deck. Next slide, please. One of the things, though, we did do, because we weren't able to do as much in terms of direct marketing to consumers, we were able to repurpose some of the dollars that we had available to get it into the hands of the communities throughout the state that really needed the help. When I say communities, I'm referring to a lot of the destination marketing organizations throughout the state. So we created two tourism crisis grant programs of about $2.3 million. And these were repurposed dollars that went to communities with very little strings attached. We did not have a match involved with these. We didn't have requirements that had to be used for out of state, because so many DMOs did not have the dollars because of decreased lodging tax dollars to promote their markets. We wanted them to be able to do it in a way that could most help communities all throughout the state. Next slide, please. We also, this fall, in order to, this somewhat answers the question earlier about what we're doing to support restaurants and bars. We wanted to thank Minnesotans. This was about around Thanksgiving time. that we thought it was really important to instill confidence, to tell people it's okay to do takeout. It's okay to support your local bars, to do eating outside when you can do that. And so we did we called it a state of gratitude. We used a lot of social media images of people throughout Minnesota that were supporting local businesses, local hospitality businesses, and thanking Minnesotans for what they have been doing to support our industry. Because without that support of Minnesotans, these businesses just would not be able to survive. So we want to do everything we can. Normally we try to bring non-resident dollars into the state, but right now we had to keep Minnesotans supporting, keeping hospitality strong. Next slide, please. To the question of the governor's budget. The governor's budget proposed $14.2 million for fiscal year 2022, $14.4 million for fiscal year 23. There is a slight adjustment, approximately 1% change in our overall appropriation from the previous biennium to this biennium. So this is basically to cover increased operating costs, human resources, et cetera. But we'll have to use whatever innovative ideas that we have to become more efficient with the resources that we have. Next slide, please. A couple slides here, and I'll just quickly wrap up if there's any other questions. But I did want to share one other slide from this survey that we asked of the industry. We asked them, when did they expect business to return to something close to pre-pandemic levels? And again, the survey was done at the end of last year. But the vast majority of the respondents in all businesses, accommodations, restaurants, attractions, felt that they're looking at the second half of 2021. But if you go beyond that, you actually have almost 38 to 40% are basically predicting to the year 2022 or beyond. So we're in for a long haul here, and businesses are just, they're hoping to see a gradual recovery. They're hoping that the vaccine as it rolls out will help, but it's going to be a while before we get back to the way that we were at the beginning of this pandemic. Next slide, please. We also asked, this is actually, I wanted to share this with you too, because this is a consumer sentiment survey that was done on a national level. And it asked, what plans do people have for traveling over the next 6 months? And basically what it says is that, and this is a pretty close to real-time data, the last week that the survey went out was the 20th of January, but 65% of consumers do have travel plans sometime in the next 6 months. There is this incredible pent-up demand. People want to get out. They're not going to go as far as they have in the past. They're not going to travel necessarily as much by airplane, but they do feel that need to get out and explore things that are in their own backyard. And so that gives us some sentiment of hope for the recovery of the leisure and hospitality industry. And then the last slide, please. And the last slide is, and if you have time, take a look at this TV spot that we already have in the can that we're going to start this next spring, summer, not only in Minnesota and surrounding states. We want to promote the Minnesota travel product. We want to provide an aspirational message, but we want people to think about, imagine that the adventure that awaits them by exploring Minnesota. And so we hope to get that out and to instill consumer confidence and do what we can to rebuild the leisure and hospitality industry in Minnesota. Next slide, and that's about it, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or any of your members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Edmund. Do people in your profession, are they planning for this to be the roaring 20s once the pandemic is over?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that our industry is incredibly hopeful, but it's going, there is actually this pent-up demand. I heard the phrase one time referred to as revenge travel. People just want to get out. They can't wait to get out and explore things in their own backyard, but it's going to depend on what segment of the industry you're talking about. I was at a meeting this morning regarding the group travel market. That's going to be a lot longer. It's going to take a lot longer for that industry segment to come back, as well as international. That's probably one of the last things to come back. But there is a lot of hope on our industry's part for our industry to come back. It will be gradual, but I do firmly believe that our industry will bounce back And it's just going to take a little while and not as fast as we might like.
So members, we have a few questions here. I am going to defer the Met Council presentation till a later meeting because I think this is very important for us to do the Explore Minnesota Tourism. And so we've got about 10 minutes here. So I've got Representative Heinzman, Representative Jordan, and then Representative Igo, and then Representative Becker Finn. So Ms. Barajas with the Met Council, I apologize, but we will get you in at a later date. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you for the extra time with Explore Minnesota, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. We're going to need some extra time also, of course, when other folks come to present. So thank you for that. John, I just want to start off by saying I really appreciate your work at the helm of Explore Minnesota Tourism. You have been really critical in your agency to Greater Minnesota and to tourism around the state. And I just want to thank you for all the work through the years and through this difficult time as well. I have a couple of questions because I am concerned. A number of subject areas and state government received from the governor's office in his budget some recommendations that were far above where they currently are. And I'm noticing that Explore Minnesota didn't receive that kind of support from the governor's office. And of course, Greater Minnesota really depends on that and the work that Explore does. And I'm going to tie it back to one of the slides that you showed that was trying to predict and get feedback from, I guess, more specifically from business owners in terms of what their predictions were for 2021. And, you know, they seem very hopeful, as you put it, I agree. But of course, the governor is really the one deciding whether my restaurants and bars and other venues are going to be open. And I guess my question is, number one, about that budget request. I'm hoping that we see some positive numbers maybe over the course of session change for the better. But also then, is the governor communicating with Explore and giving you an idea what to expect? Because businesses can guess all they want. But if the governor is there saying you're not going to open or you're going to be closed, that of course is a huge concern that they have. And, you know, there's a lot of factors, I get that, that play into how the governor makes those decisions, but being hopeful is one thing. I would like to hear that the governor is talking to Explore and helping you message, because a lot of that business is going right across the border.
Mr. Edmund, and then I'm going to move quickly with each of the three hands that are still up. So Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for those comments. I do know, as I think you do as well, that the governor does have some direct assistance in terms of small business grants to hospitality businesses. I think that was his way to help businesses really fill the hole, the need of what they have right now to operate. In terms of marketing, I think it's just a matter of the limited dollars that are available. Hopefully, if there are additional dollars that are available down the road, that we're able to do that to really focus on consumers, to get them to travel and to support our businesses again. We have been in discussion, particularly with Commissioner Grove. He's involved in several hospitality roundtables. I know he's hearing from the restaurant industry, from the convention industry, and from meetings and conventions, and taking a lot of that information back to the governor as he balances all of those inputs in trying to make his decisions. But I at this point, I can't give you any, I know you weren't asking me this, Representative Heinzman, I can't give you insights into when those protocols might change, but we're making sure that he is aware of what the impact is of our industry and what the future is for travel in our state.
So, Representative Igo, what I'm gonna do is have each of the three of you ask your question and then see if Mr. Edmund can answer all three of them. So Representative Igo first, and then Representative Jordan, and then Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so my question, and I'll echo Representative Heinzman by saying thank you for what you do. You know, like I said, I come from the land of the three T's, right? Timber, taconite, and tourism. So my just quick comment and almost question is, I was really struck by the numbers that on average, you know, in the coming weeks, 70% of people are going to be wanting to travel. And I just, you know, hope that Explore Minnesota would continue to work with the governor and share the reports like that, because I know that my constituents are tired of watching the grocery stores and the Targets and the Walmarts be full of people while our restaurants and are struggling to be fully capacity. So if you could just express that to the governor and work with him so that, you know, if we can open up with these coming trends and this kind of revenge traveling, that'd be fantastic. So that's my question. Thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation, Mr. Edmond. I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit about the impacts of outdoor recreation on the tourism industry and how that has been impacted by the pandemic. I know, for example, I've actually spent more time in the state of Minnesota looking for outdoor recreation opportunities. Representative Blewick, you have a really great district to get outside on my bike or go fishing in particular. But can you talk a little bit about the impact generally on outdoor recreation and how that has changed last year?
And Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was very similar to Representative Jordan's. You know, what I'm seeing with residents of my area in the suburbs is that they're more likely to drive places within Minnesota right now than to visit some of those places that they otherwise would have traveled by plane or something else like that. So also had a question about how some of those businesses, I know, you know, many businesses are struggling, obviously, including, you know, malls and Rosedale and all the places close to my area. But just was wondering about if some areas were actually doing better because folks are stuck in Minnesota where they can drive.
Mr. Edmond.
Well, Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'll try to tackle all three questions at once if I possibly can. First of all, I guess the question about, it's very appropriate actually that we as an agency at this point in time are in this committee, because that is the outdoors, the natural resources, that's where people are gravitating to right now. Those are the socially safe things that people can do. This last summer, we saw such an increase in things like sales of fishing license, people outside golfing, people outside hiking. People were trying to do those kind of activities this summer. They're doing the same thing in the wintertime, the cross-country skiing, the snowshoeing, the ice fishing. Those are the activities where we've seen such an incredible increase in participation, because that's, as I said, people want to get outside, and those are the things that they safely can do. In terms of sort of the regional question about where people are doing these things, they are, Greater Minnesota is actually benefiting to some degree more so than the metro area, because those are, they have the product, the outdoor product, where people are escaping to those smaller towns, the resorts and the campgrounds and things like that to enjoy that. It's the metropolitan area that's been hurting, because even more so because of the lot, when you think about it, the loss of the meetings and the conventions, the sports, the theater, those are the kind of things you can't do. And so the lodging revenue that comes from that is just not there. And that's going to be a little bit harder to bring back. So we're seeing Greater Minnesota in terms of overall numbers, not necessarily always good, but better than sort of the metro area. And to the question regarding sharing with the governor, we've been not only been trying to share this information, I've shared this report, not this committee report, but that recent survey with the governor's office. But I just got a confirmation from this morning that he's going to address our industry at the tourism conference coming up in March. So hopefully you'll hear more directly from our businesses about how important our industry is to him as he's making this decision. So, Mr. Chair, hopefully I tackled all three questions.
I think you got all three. And Mr. Edmond, that report, can we get that so we can post it on our website if it's not already?
All right. Certainly, Mr. Chair.
And then members can share that with their constituents. That would be awesome, because it's good to get that feedback out to people. So members, we have 1 minute left. I want to thank you for a great meeting. Next week, we are going to be bringing up the 2021 LCCMR bill and then a couple of PFAS bills. So we will also try to make time for some of the agencies. So. And I would encourage you, Representative Heinzman, if you can work with Representative Wozlawick on the PFAS issue. I know, I think you may have talked already, but I'm hopeful that we can find some common ground on that. And with that, we are adjourned.